Thank you, General. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ranking Member, members of the committee. As General Alexander said, and as the Chairman and Ranking Member have said, all of us in the national security area are constantly trying to balance protecting public safety with protecting people's privacy and civil liberties in this government, and it's a constant job at balancing this. We think we've done this in these instances. There are statutes that are passed by Congress. This is not a program that's off the books, that's been hidden away. This is part of what government puts together and discusses. Statutes are passed. It is overseen by three branches of our government: the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive branch. The process of oversight occurs before, during, and after the processes that we're talking about today. And I want to talk a little bit about how that works, what the legal framework is, and what some of the protections are that are put into it. First of all, what we have seen published in the newspaper concerning 215, this is the business records provisions of the Patriot Act that also modify FISA. You've seen one order in the newspaper that's a couple of pages long that just says, under that order, we're allowed to acquire metadata, telephone records. That's one of two orders. It's the smallest of the two orders. And the other order, which has not been published, goes into, in great detail, what we can do with that metadata, how we can access it, how we can look through it, what we can do with it once we have looked through it, and what the conditions are that are placed on us to make sure that we protect privacy and civil liberties and at the same time protect public safety. Let me go through a few of the features of this. First of all, it's metadata. These are phone records. This is just like what you would get in your own phone bill. It is the number that was dialed from, the number that was dialed to, the date, and the length of time. That's all we get under 215. We do not get the identity of any of the parties to this phone call. We don't get any cell site or location information as to where any of these phones were located, and most importantly, and you're probably going to hear this about 100 times today, we don't get any content under this. We don't listen in on anybody's calls under this program at all. This is under, as I said, Section 215 of the Patriot Act. This has been debated and up for reauthorization and reauthorized twice by the United States Congress since its inception in 2006 and in 2011. Now, in order, the way it works is there is an application that is made by the FBI under the statute to the FISA court. We call it the FISC. They ask for and receive permission from the FISC under this to get records that are relevant to a national security investigation. And they must demonstrate to the FISC that it will be operated under the guidelines that are set forth by the Attorney General under Executive Order 12333. This is what covers intelligence gathering in the federal government. It is limited to tangible objects. Now, what does that mean? These are like records, like the metadata, the phone records I've been describing. But it is quite explicitly limited to things that you could get with a grand jury subpoena, those kinds of records. Now, it's important to know, prosecutors issue grand jury subpoenas all the time and do not need any involvement of a court or anybody else, really, to do so. Under this program, we need to get permission from the court to issue this ahead of time. So there is court involvement with the issuance of these orders, which is different from a grand jury subpoena, but the type of records, just documents, business records, things like that, are limited to those same types of records that we could get through a grand jury subpoena. Now, the orders that we get last 90 days. So we have to re-up and renew these orders every 90 days in order to do this. Now, there are strict controls over what we can do under the order. And again, that's the bigger, thicker order that hasn't been published. There's restrictions on who can access it in this order. It is stored in repositories at NSA that can only be accessed by a limited number of people, and the people who are allowed to access it have to have special and rigorous training about the standards under which that they can access it. In order to access it, there needs to be a finding that there is reasonable suspicion that you can articulate, that you can put into words, that the person whose phone records you want to query is involved with some sort of terrorist organizations, and they are defined. It's not everyone. They're limited in the statute. So there has to be independent evidence, aside from these phone records, that the person you're targeting is involved with a terrorist organization. If that person is a United States person, a citizen, or a lawful permanent resident, you have to have something more than just their own speeches, their own readings, their own First Amendment type activity. You have to have additional evidence beyond that that indicates that there is reasonable, articulable suspicion that these people are associated with specific terrorist organizations. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is under the law, the Fourth Amendment does not apply to these records. There is a case quite a number of years ago by the Supreme Court that indicated that toll records, phone records like this that don't include any content, are not covered by the Fourth Amendment because people don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in who they called and when they called. That's something you show to the phone company. That's something you show to many, many people within the phone company on a regular basis. Once those records are accessed under this process and reasonable, articulable suspicion is found, that's found by specially trained people. It is reviewed by their supervisors. It is documented in writing ahead of time so that somebody can take a look at it. Any of the accessing that is done in an auditable fashion. There is a trail of it. So both the decision and the facts that support the accessing and the query is documented. The amount that was done, what was done, all of that is documented and reviewed and audited on a fairly regular basis. There are also minimization procedures that are put into place so that any of the information that is acquired has to be minimized, it has to be limited, and its use is strictly limited, and all that is set out in the terms of the court order. And if any U.S. persons are involved, there are particular restrictions on how any information concerning a U.S. person can be used in this. Now, there is extensive oversight and compliance that is done with these records and with this process. Every now and then there may be a mistake, a wrong phone number is hit, or a person who shouldn't have been targeted gets targeted because there's a mistake in the phone record, something like that. Each of those compliance incidents, if and when they occur, have to be reported to the FISA court immediately. And let me tell you, the FISA court pushes back on this. They want to find out, why did this happen? What were the procedures and the mechanisms that allowed it to happen? And what have you done to fix it? So whenever we have a compliance incident, we report it to the court immediately, and we report it to Congress. We report it to the intelligence committees of both houses and the judiciary committees of both houses. We also provide the intelligence and judiciary committees with any significant interpretations that the court makes of the 215 statute. If they make a ruling that is significant, or issue an order that is significant in its interpretation, we provide those as well as the applications we made for those orders to the Intelligence Committee and to the Judiciary Committee. And every 30 days, we are filing with the FISC, with the court, a report that describes how we implement this program. It includes a discussion of how we're applying the reasonable, articulable suspicion standard. It talks about the number of approved queries that we made against this database, the number of instances that the query results in containing U.S. person information that was shared outside of NSA, and all of this goes to the court. At least once every 90 days, and sometimes more frequently, the Department of Justice, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and the NSA meet to assess NSA's compliance with all of these requirements that are contained in the court order. Separately, the Department of Justice meets with the Inspector General for the National Security Agency and assesses NSA's compliance on a regular basis. Finally, there is, by statute, reporting of certain information that goes to Congress in semi-annual reports that we make on top of the periodic reports we make if there's a compliance incident. And those include information about the data that was required and how we are performing under this statute. So once again, keeping in mind, all of this is done with three branches of government involved: oversight and initiation by the executive branch with review by multiple agencies, statutes that are passed by Congress, oversight by Congress, and then oversight by the court. Now, the 702 statute under the FISA Amendments Act is different. Under this, we do get content. But there's a big difference. You are only allowed under 702 to target, for this purpose, non-U.S. persons who are located outside of the United States. So if you have a U.S. permanent resident who's in Madrid, Spain, we can't target them under 702. Or if you have a non-U.S. person who's in Cleveland, Ohio, we cannot target them under 702. In order to target a person, they have to be neither a citizen nor a permanent U.S. resident, and they need to be outside of the United States while we're targeting them. Now, there's prohibitions in this statute. For example, you can't reverse target somebody. This is where you target somebody who's out of the United States, but really your goal is to capture conversations with somebody who is inside the United States. So you're trying to do indirectly what you couldn't do directly. That is explicitly prohibited by this statute. And if there is ever any indication that it's being done, because again, we report the use that we make of this statute to the court and to the Congress, that is seen. You also have to have a valid foreign intelligent purpose in order to do any of the targeting on this. So you have to make sure, as it was described, that it's being done for defined categories of weapons of mass destruction, foreign intelligence, things of that nature. These are all done pursuant to an application that is made by the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence to the FISC. The FISC gives a certificate that allows this targeting to be done for a year period. It then has to be renewed at the end of that year in order for it to be re-upped. Now, there is a requirement that, again, there is reporting. You cannot, under the terms of this statute, have and collect any information on conversations that are wholly within the United States. So you're targeting someone outside the United States. If they make a call to inside the United States, that can be collected. But it's only because the target of that call outside the United States initiated that call and went there. If the calls are wholly within the United States, we cannot collect them. If you're targeting a person who is outside of the United States and you find that they come into the United States, we have to stop the targeting right away. And if there's any lag and we find out that we collected information because we weren't aware that they were in the United States, we have to take that information, purge it from the systems, and not use it. Now, there's a great deal of minimization procedures that are involved here, particularly concerning any of the acquisition of information that deals or comes from U.S. persons. As I said, only targeting people outside the United States who are not U.S. persons. But if we do acquire any information that relates to a U.S. person, under limited criteria only can we keep it. If it has to do with foreign intelligence in that conversation or understanding foreign intelligence or evidence of a crime or a threat of serious bodily injury, we can respond to that. Other than that, we have to get rid of it, we have to purge it, and we can't use it. If we inadvertently acquire any of it without meaning to, again, once that's discovered, we have to get rid of it, we have to purge it. The targeting decisions that are done are, again, documented ahead of time reviewed by a supervisor before they're ever allowed to take place in the beginning. The Department of Justice and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence conduct on-site reviews of each targeting that is done. They look at them to determine and go through the audit to determine that they were done properly. This is done at least every 60 days, and many times done more frequently than that. In addition, if there's any compliance issue, it is immediately reported to the FISC. The FISC again pushes back. How did this happen? What are the procedures? What are the mechanisms you're using to fix this? What have you done to remedy it? If you acquired information you should have you gotten rid of it as you're required? And in addition, we're providing Congress with all of that information if we have compliance problems. We also report quarterly to the FISC concerning the compliance issues that have arisen during that quarter, on top of the immediate reports and what we've done to fix it and remedy the ones that we've reported. We also, to Congress under this program, the Department of Justice and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence provide a semi-annual report to the FISC and to Congress, assessing all of our compliance with the targeting and minimization procedures that are contained in the court order. We also provide a semi-annual report to the FISC and to Congress concerning the implementation of the program, what we've done and what we found. And we also provide to Congress documents that contain, again, how we're dealing with the minimization procedures, any significant legal interpretations that the FISC makes concerning these statutes, as well as the orders and the applications that would relate to that. And on top of all of this, annually, the Inspector General for NSA does an assessment which he provides to Congress that reports on compliance, the number of disseminations under this program that relate to U.S. persons, the number of targets that were reasonably believed at the time to be outside the United States who were later determined to be in the United States, and what that was done. So in short, there is, from before, during, and after, the involvement of all three branches of the United States government on a robust and fairly intimate way. I'd like to make one other observation, if I may, on this. We have tried to do this in as thorough, as protective, and as transparent a way as we possibly can, considering it is the gathering of intelligence information. Countries and allies of ours all over the world collect intelligence. We all know this. And there have recently been studies about how transparent our system is in the United States compared to many of our partners, many in the EU, countries like France, the UK, Germany, who we work with regularly. And a report that was just recently issued in May of this year found that the FISA Amendments Act, the statute that we're talking about here, and I will quote, imposes at least as much, if not more, due process and oversight on foreign intelligence surveillance than other countries, and this includes EU countries. And that under this, the U.S. is much more transparent about its procedures, requires more due process protections in its investigations that involve national security, terrorism, and foreign intelligence. The balance is always one we seek to strive to achieve. But I think, as I've laid out to you, we have done everything we can to achieve it, and I think part of the proof of what we've done is this report that came out just last month indicating our system is as good and, frankly, better than all of our allies and liaison partners. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.